court is ready to hear argument from relators in In Re Entergy Corporation.
May it please the court, I want to focus my presentation this morning on two issues. First, relators will demonstrate that the Beaumont Court abused its discretion in failing to dismiss this case because exclusive jurisdiction over plaintiff's claims lies with the Public Utility Commission of Texas. Second, relators will demonstrate that mandamus relief is required in this case to address the district court's ongoing interference with the Public Utility Commission's orders and activities. In 1993, the Public Utility Commission adopted a settlement agreement as its order approving the merger of Energy Corporation and Gulf States Utilities Company. The settlement agreement, as adopted in the Commission's order, established a regulatory plan. That plan was for three rate cases to be conducted ultimately under the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction. The PUC has continuously exercised jurisdiction over that regulatory plan, and in recent orders has determined that the regulatory plan must be changed to accommodate SB 7, the legislation which has brought about retail competition in the electric industry in Texas. In the face of the PUC's ongoing assertion of jurisdiction, the plaintiffs purport to bring a suit alleging that relators breached that same 1993 settlement agreement that the PUC adopted as its order. But this is not a simple contract case. This is fundamentally a case about whether relator Energy Gulf States should have filed a rate case and should have changed its rates. The settlement agreement provided no contract right to the plaintiffs to receive any particular payment of merger savings or any particular payment at all from either Energy Gulf States or Energy Corporation.
Now, my understanding is they don't claim that rates should have been changed, but just that the savings percentage should have changed.
That's their claim.
The tariff would stay the same.
That's their claim, Your Honor. But if you look at the agreement, it's clear that what they are requesting is a change in rates. The claim breached, the plaintiffs assert, is Energy Gulf State's failure to file a rate case. Their so-called damages are the difference between what Energy Gulf State's rates would be with and without that third rate case, with and without that flow-through of merger savings. As the PUC itself agrees in its amicus brief, this is a change in rates. Indeed, the agreement they sue on itself is a rate under the definition of the Public Utility Regulatory Act. As the court will recall, the Public Utility Regulatory Act defines rates as including any compensation or charge made by the utility, any contract or practice affecting such charges. So clearly under that broad definition, as the PUC itself recognizes, these are rates and changes in rates. And these matters fall under the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction. The plaintiffs claimed their suit on the agreement is for damages, but the agreement's one purpose was to form the basis for a PUC order that was unenforceable, absent PUC adoption. The agreement was to be implemented by PUC orders and rate proceedings exclusively. The agreement by its own terms and the PUC's order call for implementation of a PUC regulatory plan. It was the PUC that exercised its jurisdiction to cancel, in its own words in the amicus brief, that third rate case in the regulatory plan when it determined that that third rate case was inconsistent with the requirements of Senate Bill 7.
Mr. Williams, just one question. How did SB 7, if it did, how did it change any of the rights or obligations under this agreement?
Your Honor, first of all, we contend that the rights and obligations under the agreement, that agreement itself was a recommendation for adoption of a PUC order. It could be implemented and enforced only via the PUC and its regulatory plan. So it was essentially an agreement for the PUC to adopt an order and to take jurisdiction over these matters and implement the provisions of the agreement through rate making. So in that sense, it was a broad-based requirement for setting rates. And the law in this state is that those types of provisions, those types of agreements are always subject to the state's paramount authority to change them on a prospective basis consistent with the public interest. To the extent the court's referring to Section 39.108, that, in our view, is not really the issue for this case. Section 39.108 would go to the merits of whether the commission's actions had some were contrary or violated PURA. The commission clearly took those actions. It changed the regulatory plan. That doesn't go to the jurisdictional issue. If someone didn't like the actions the commission took in carrying out the regulatory plan and in canceling that third rate case, their remedy was a direct appeal to the Travis County District Court, onto the Third Court of Appeals, and onto this court. I mean, what that demonstrates to you is what the plaintiffs are doing here is a collateral attack.
In the PUC, are you bound by the agreement still?
No, Your Honor. First, because the PUC found the agreement third rate case had been superseded by SB 7, and the agreement by its terms has expired.
Well, were you free in the third rate case to argue against the agreement because of the SB 7, or what was your position?
In the circumstances of this case, yes, Your Honor, because recall, when we brought up the third rate case in that June 2000 timeframe where the PUC ordered that the case had been canceled, prior to that time, the commission had on its own motion in the second rate case under the regulatory plan had already determined that, in fact, SB 7 had superseded the requirement for that 2001 rate case. You'll recall that in that case, in 1999, we settled that second rate case. We proposed a settlement agreement to the commission that said, we agree, we'll file that third rate case, and we'll address these two or three issues specifically in that third rate case. The commission did not adopt that part of our settlement. The commission specifically took that agreement and did not put it in its order. Instead, it said, you're going to address those issues, not in this 2001 rate case, but in the Senate Bill 7 proceedings. So as early as 1999, the commission had on its own decided that the Senate Bill 7 called for a new regulatory plan, so to speak, that did not include that third rate case.
In the Real Party and Interest brief on page 9, they say that Entergy Corp. attempted to insulate itself from any challenge to the merger savings by entering into a purported rate freeze and including a poison pill for any party that attempted to recover savings through operation of the agreement. What were they talking about?
You know, they're talking about the order by the Public Utility Commission at the end of 2001 that decided that the transition to competition in Energy Gulf States service territory would be delayed. Under the Public Utility Regulatory Act, Section 39.103, the PUC has discretion to decide that a particular area of the state is not quite ready for competition, that more things need to be set in place, and to delay competition. And in connection with the proceeding to determine whether competition should be delayed for Energy Gulf States, the parties entered into a settlement agreement. It was, however, non-unanimous. The commission used that non-unanimous settlement agreement as a basis for its order and ordered delaying competition and continuing the rate freeze that is already in place as a matter of statutory law. But the poison pill aspect of it, I'm sorry, it took me a long time to get around to that. That was not a poison pill, Your Honor. What that was in order to ensure rate stability during this transition to competition period, the commission agreed and ordered, not simply adopting a sale, but ordered in the public interest that should a rate case be filed, Gulf States would be able to recover the expenses that had already incurred in trying to transition to competition, but only to the extent necessary to avoid a rate decrease. So I think it just highlights even more that the commission is asserting jurisdiction on a continuous basis, trying to get the company to move to competition. And what the Beaumont Court is doing in conducting this rate case is stepping right in the middle of those efforts. Here, when the commission, this goes to our mandamus issue, I think, here, where the commission in June 2000 and again in 2001 has ordered twice that no rate case will be conducted, except to the extent we say so. First, it canceled the rate case, and the Beaumont Court is trying to conduct the very rate case the commission canceled. Then the commission went on and said, no rate case is going to be held until we say so. We're going to concentrate our efforts on carrying out these other proceedings we've got to get done to get Energy Gulf States service territory to competition. Right in the midst of that, the Beaumont Court is, in effect, conducting that rate case. And that's where, and as I say, this goes to our mandamus point, I believe, because this court has consistently held that mandamus is available to prevent a court from interfering with another administrative body that has exclusive jurisdiction. And that's as recently as this past summer. And this is a case, Your Honors, that I did not cite in my brief because it was decided after we filed the brief. And that is a Ray State Bar of Texas. It's a 113 Southwest 3rd, 730. It's a unanimous decision of this court, authored by Justice Schneider. In that case, the Board of Disciplinary Appeals had exclusive jurisdiction over lawyer discipline. It had conducted a proceeding revoking a lawyer's probation and suspending his license. After that, the lawyer went to a Beaumont District Court and asked that court to, in essence, set aside, hold for naught, that Board of Disciplinary Appeals judgment. This court granted mandamus relief to prevent the Beaumont Court from interfering with the Board of Disciplinary Appeals continuing jurisdiction over that license suspension. We have the same thing here. When the commission in June 2000 entered that order canceling the rate case, it maintained continuing jurisdiction over that order as one of the two or three proceedings it had going, moving forward to put Energy Gulf State Service Territory in competition. The Beaumont Court of Appeals, the Beaumont District Court's conduct of this rate case is directly interfering with that ongoing jurisdiction of the PUC.
Who reaped the benefit of the merger savings in the third year, in the third, whatever you call it, biennium?
The, in other words, if everything had just stayed status quo, in the third rate...
No, now. Who, sitting here today, who reaped the benefit of the merger savings? Who is receiving those benefits?
Well, the share of merger savings was included in Energy Gulf States as an element of Energy Gulf States rates in the last case. But I would tell you, Your Honor, recall that there is no guarantee, no payment of a particular amount of merger savings to any ratepayer. All that happens is that merger savings are included in rates. They're a cost in rates. The ultimate outcome is whatever it is, including all of Energy Gulf States' costs. And Energy Gulf States...
What's the purpose of the settlement agreement, then, if that's the case?
It's to allow those to become the base of a commission order, which would allow those merger savings to be included in rates. That is the purpose. Our position would be, and we discussed this, this really goes to the merits more than the jurisdictional issue.
Well, I guess where I'm confused is that in the first two, can we call them biennials? Would that be right? The first two time periods of the settlement agreement, the merger savings were allocated 50-50. My understanding is the third year, the third time period, it was intended under the settlement agreement that all the savings would go 100% to the plaintiffs here.
And the point I'm trying
to... Now, none of it is going to the plaintiffs here. It's all going to Entergy. Is that correct?
It is included as an element of Entergy's rates. And again, if the plaintiffs want to make a complaint about that, they can bring that complaint to the PUC. That's the proper jurisdiction.
So they could seek to enforce that piece of the agreement before the PUC?
They could claim that we had violated the PUC's order. It's as simple as that. They could claim we violated the PUC's order by not filing that rate case and not passing those merger savings on to the ratepayers through that vehicle. Yeah. But the fact is, Your Honor, I mean, we've been making filings under SB 7 that show our revenues and costs, including those merger savings. And if this case came to a litigation, we'd ask for a rate increase. So. The fact that merger savings are included in rates doesn't automatically mean the ratepayers end up with a $50 million or $2 million a month payment. It's just an element of rates. The outcome of that rate case, the ratepayers could be better off without the rate case being filed. And as I say, ultimately, they can that is a claim they can bring to the Public Utility Commission. And the Public Utility Commission, we think, would reject it, but they could certainly free to entertain it and act on it within their exclusive jurisdiction. I see my time is about up. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from real party.
May it please the Court. Next month will be the 10th anniversary of this agreement that's in dispute here this morning. And there are two important conclusions of law that were stated in the Commission's order that approved an order consistent with that agreement. They didn't approve the agreement. They approved an order consistent with the agreement. The first conclusion of law is conclusion of law two. The Commission said we have no jurisdiction over Entergy Corp. Clear as day. The second conclusion of law is conclusion of law 14. Which addressed a contract dispute in that litigation. And the Commission stated, we have no jurisdiction over this contract dispute. Those two conclusions of law can be found in the record at 5AA, Volume 1. Now, 10 years later, those conclusions of law are still the same. Relator has now conceded in their brief that the Public Utility Commission does not have jurisdiction over Entergy Corp. And I would also add that case law would suggest that the courts of this state have jurisdiction over implementation of the agreement. Now let's just talk about this agreement for a moment. It was a merger case. That means under PURA 63, it was PURA 63 at that time. It's currently...
Does interpretation or enforcement of the agreement affect rates in any way?
No. In this case, when we file for damages, if we're successful at the trial court level, it's likely to be Entergy Corp, the sole shareholder who's been getting these benefits and the owner of EGSI, who will pay the damages.
And why did you sue EGSI?
Excuse me?
Why did you sue EGSI as well?
Well, they were both signatories to the contract, and they were both involved in what I would best describe as the mischief in terms of not complying with the agreement. And I'll just get to that point right now, and I know there's been a lot of questions. Did SB7, or what did the Commission do in these cases? In the settlement case that where we believe the agreement was violated, under, I think it's paragraph 22 of the agreement, the Commission, the company agreed, or Relator agreed, it would fully support the agreement. When SB7 came along, all these companies were supposed to go to competition. In this case, Entergy, or EGSI, its market wasn't ready for competition. So the Public Utility staff filed a docket or a motion for the Commission to investigate whether or not EGSI was ready for competition. That was not a rate case. It was just an investigation on competition. Once the Commission started the case, a lot of issues had to be decided. It was the relator who, with other parties, entered into a settlement agreement. Rates were not an issue, but they made it an issue when they put rates in the settlement agreement saying, we will freeze rates. They submitted that settlement agreement to the Public Utility Commission of Texas for approval. It was that entering that settlement agreement where they said they would freeze rates that violated the third rate case requirement that they had previously agreed to. And so in that docket, we believe the company or the relator has...
How could they not have frozen rates in light of the legislative action?
Because the legislative action says that under 39103, if you delay competition, Commission, then the rates will be regulated pursuant to Chapter 36. In other words, we go to the old method of regulation, just like we never had deregulation. And that's what everybody would have expected. And had they followed that, and you're under Chapter 36 of PURA, then any rate case can occur. They could have filed their third rate case, and the savings that Justice O'Neill was asking about would have flowed.
Then why don't you file an enforcement action at the PUC?
We could have filed a complaint case, but it was the poison pill that you asked about a moment ago, Justice. The poison pill consisted of, if anybody files a rate case, then all these past expenses associated with the getting ready for competition will be included in this new rate case up to the amount of keeping the rates the same. So if my clients challenge those rates, they would have had enormous amounts of expenses to throw in. These expenses are not ordinarily thrown
but
into.
That was done by the PUC did that.
No, that was done in the settlement. I'm sorry.
But it couldn't have been implemented without the PUC.
That's true.
So whatever you want to call it, that's a PUC order.
That is a PUC order.
And you're bound by that.
Yes, we are, and that's why we haven't.
But you're trying to make an end run around that by not going to the PUC.
No, Your Honor, because there's another reason, and that is we don't have a remedy at the PUC. Remember, this case was supposed to be filed, and the savings were supposed to be shared starting on.
Why don't you go to the PUC to enforce your agreement and make them file the rate case?
Well, I just said the poison pill wouldn't have done us any good. And second, there is no remedy because we couldn't incur or ask the PUC to retroactively get these dollars or savings that flowed to the company and give them back to the plaintiffs.
If these dollars are awarded in damages, won't that affect rates?
No.
Why not?
And the reason is the PUC is the only one that's going to change rates. And let's assume we're successful at the trial court. We're awarded damages. Entergy Corp pays a judgment. EGSI's rates are unaffected. They can charge the same rate they charge today. So any judgment will not affect the EGSI rate. Entergy Corp is not under the Public Utility Commission jurisdiction. Energy Corp is a New Orleans company that's the sole shareholder, that's the one that's been getting all of these benefits.
So if EGSI were publicly held, you would be suing the shareholders of EGSI, individual shareholders?
There's only one shareholder.
That's not my question.
I'm
if
sorry.
They were publicly held, you would be suing the individual shareholders of EGSI.
In that hypothetical, I guess we would, but that's not the situation before us today.
What difference does it make whether it's individual shareholders or one corporation?
Well, I think the power of the one corporation in this case to exert its influence over the EGSI and how this agreement was to be implemented and the benefits this one shareholder gets.
How are you going to prove in the trial court that it was Entergy and not the PUC? I mean, how do you take the PUC's complicity in this out of the factor, out of the equation?
I don't know that I defined it as PUC complicity, but I would say that Entergy Corp, the PUC approved an order. No question about it. I concede that, and that's the order. But would they have approved that order? Was Entergy or EGSI that brought them that order, that brought them that settlement? EGSI could still file a case today, even with that order. The president of the company of EGSI, I deposed. And it's in the record that he said he could file a case today. So it's EGSI.
And you could go to the commission and force them to file a case today.
I could, and I could not get my back damages. I could not ask the commission to retroactively go back.
But you
and
could
get
have
those
filed
things.
As much sooner, is my point.
Yes, I could.
You had a remedy at the commission.
I had a remedy. I could have filed it. I couldn't have gotten retroactive damages.
And my specific question is, when you go to try the jury case, how do you factor out what the PUC has done? How can you prove that they would have done something different had Entergy filed something different?
Well, I think I would go by the statute. Under 39-103, it says you shall regulate rates under the old method, which is Chapter 36. Under Chapter 36, there is no power of the PUC to freeze rates.
So you're asking the jury to find what the PUC would have done but for Entergy's filing?
No, I'm not going to ask them for what the PUC would have done. I think that would be speculation. I don't think we would be able to do that. But what we have is an equity problem. We have a problem where EGSI didn't file the case.
How do you prove what the PUC would have done had Entergy filed it?
Had they filed it? I think we could look at the public filings. Mr. Williams said a moment ago that this is a public utility. It does public filings. We have all the information in terms of their costs. We also have all the information of what their merger savings are.
So you're going to ask the experts basically to reconstruct what the PUC would have done?
That's possibly a way. That's not necessarily the way that we will go forward on this. I think there's an equity argument that we could say that you got this amount of savings during this period. You come here with unclean hands. You caused this problem, Entergy. Maybe in equity we should get some amount of money.
Counselor.
And that amount of money is the amount of merger-related savings that you kept for yourself by not following the agreement.
A couple of times you said that you wouldn't file an enforcement action because you are concerned about your ability to recover damages retroactively. Why should this court be concerned
And this is a jurisdictional case. We're trying to determine whether PUC has exclusive jurisdiction. So why should we be concerned whether you would get those damages or not by going through the PUC?
Well, I think you should be concerned because the plaintiffs in this case ought to have a remedy somewhere.
I'm talking but just in terms of jurisdiction. You know, where does exclusive jurisdiction lie?
Okay. Well, I think it lies, I don't think that issue addresses the exclusive jurisdiction. I believe that the jurisdiction belongs at the trial court, and that is not the reason why we're at the trial court, or the only reason why we're at the trial court, because we couldn't get a retroactive remedy. I believe the trial court can address this contract problem. The relator has admitted in their briefs that Entergy Corp is not regulated by the PUC. If I brought Entergy Corp to the PUC, what would the PUC do with them?
I'm a little bit confused. If EGSI had filed this third rate case, gone ahead and filed it, then you wouldn't have a breach of contract claim.
That's correct.
And if they had filed it and the PUC had said just what it said in its order, that Senate Bill 7 undoes the agreement, therefore we dismiss the rate case, you would not have a case.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
So the PUC order saying there is no case here and rates are frozen, the only breach then is that they didn't perform a futile act by filing the rate case.
Yes, they made an agreement that they would file a rate case. They violated that agreement when they told the PUC, hey, here's a settlement. We'll freeze our rates. Accept this. And that was...
You didn't want them to file a rate case, did you? Didn't you just say if a rate case had been filed, it would have all these... savings would have been recaptured? I mean, all these expenses? That's the poison pill that you're talking about?
No, the poison pill would have had nothing. If they had filed a case, they were due to file a case in November of 19, right before deregulation started, November of 2001. Along comes November 2001. We didn't have this poison pill. We didn't have any of those issues. They would have just filed an ordinary rate case. And in the context of that ordinary rate case, the commission would have set rates, but the key provision in that rate-setting process, they would have taken out those merger-related savings that were considered hypothetical costs going to the shareholder, Entergy Corp. And they would have set rates, and we believe those rates would have been lower, and we would have been getting our savings back. But what happened instead was they entered into a settlement agreement to freeze their rates, and in addition to that, in that settlement agreement, they entered the poison pill.
My understanding is Senate Bill 7 did that.
No, that is not correct.
Well, okay, this letter from H.P. Wright dated May 19, 1999, Senate Bill 7 undoes the agreement. It freezes rates.
That Mr. Wright did write that letter. I concede that, but it is not a correct portrayal of what Senate Bill 7 does. Senate Bill 7, what would happen if Senate Bill 7 were implemented? This is the easier way to put it. If Senate Bill 7 were implemented and they had gone to competition, those merger savings would have been pulled out and those competitive rates we have under Senate Bill 7 would have excluded the competitive rates. The relator admits they would have done that. But that case got abated. They didn't go to competition. Now, what does Senate Bill 7 do? Senate Bill 7 tells us that if you delay competition, then you go back to the old way of regulation, Chapter 36. And that's not what was done here. They entered into a settlement with the commission to freeze their rates. Moreover, I would point out to the court that if you look at Section 31002.8 of PURA, it's a definition of rate freeze. The legislature defined a rate freeze as the period January 1st, 1999 through 12/31/01. The legislature in Senate Bill 7 made a rate freeze a defined term. The PUC, I would think, is without authority to create a new rate freeze. The legislature didn't give them that authority. The legislature said you will go back to Chapter 36 regulation. But now we have the PUC, through this agreement, extending what the definition of a rate freeze is.
Why didn't you appeal that?
Excuse me?
Why didn't you appeal that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Why did you not appeal? You say the PUC did something it didn't have legislative authority to do. Why didn't you appeal that?
That case is being appealed at the PUC by a number of parties. It's still in the process of the appellate process. I believe it's at the District Court of Travis County. I don't believe that case is yet to be heard. But that case has been appealed.
Mr. Lawton, if the settlement were completed by all the parties,
yes,
and the almost $600 million in savings from the merger were allocated per the settlement agreement, and there had been no Senate Bill 7, no change, how would the savings allocated to the customers have been distributed to the customers?
Well, under the whole $600 million, that number you saw in the brief, that was an estimate of how much savings there were in the first 8 or 10 years. The way it would have been distributed would have been 50-50. That was the split that was agreed upon. The key, though, is the customer. I'm sorry.
Let me be more specific about my question.
Sure.
How would the 50% of the savings for the customers have reached the customers? Would there have been a check written? Would there have been an electronic transfer to their bank? Would their rates have changed? How would that have been distributed to the customers?
Their rates would change. The way the regulation works is the cost actually incurred by the utility get passed on to the customers. In this case, the $600 million, what was done in the agreement, a $300 million expense was put into costs. Expenses actually went down $600 million, assuming the calculations were correct. But $300 million expense was put in there, a fictitious expense. So now, out of the 600, Entergy's the one shareholder gets 300 million, and the customers get 300 million. What happened, though?
Now that rate change would have been a rate reduction.
That's
for the
correct.
Customers. But you're arguing that because of a breach of the contract, that rate reduction is not going to happen now.
That's right. In the last case, the if you look at the record, you will find the Thicket's finding of fact 141. Which indicates the biggest benefit of this merger is that after the 8th year, 100% of the savings go to customers. The commission itself recognized the biggest benefit happens after the 8th year. So that I think that's an important factor in considering all this.
Now, well, let me ask you this then. Do you agree that regulation of electric utility rates in Texas is a pervasive regulatory scheme?
Yes, I do, with regard to rates, operations, and services.
And the PUC has exclusive jurisdiction over setting rates and services in that industry?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
And because of the breach of contract, you've said the rate reduction is not going to happen. Why does this case not then involve the exclusive regulation of
Well, and I think tangentially it does. Had the company gone forward, as we just discussed a moment ago, the rate benefit would have been there. The company or the relator didn't, and so I'm looking for a place to seek redress for the plaintiffs, and I believe it's a contract claim because they breached an agreement in the first place, and the PUC has no jurisdiction over Entergy Corp. They're the big economic engine in this case. They run and control it and cost it.
But they say if there had been a rate proceeding, they would have asked for an increase.
Well, that's what they said. I would say that, too, if I would. All the utilities ask for increases. In this case, Your Honor.
So you're getting a deal, they say.
Well, if I take them at their word, but let me point out to you, there were three rate cases. The first rate case, they came in and asked the commission for $25 million increase. The commission gave them $111 million decrease. On top of that, they gave $28 million of the merger savings to their shareholder, Entergy Corp. In the second case, they came in and asked for $101 million increase. They agreed to a $4 million decrease, and their shareholder got a positive $22 million in that case. Now they come in the third case and they say, well, we're going to ask for an increase yet again, or they say they can justify it. I would contend, Your Honor, that is why they entered into a settlement to freeze their rates. They knew what was going to happen. They saw the first two cases, enormous amounts of money, going the other way when the commission was invoking its regulatory authority and jurisdiction. And so I would contend that was their motive for not filing that third case. And they can say they need a rate increase, you know, all day long, and they can say that at the courthouse. They have that defense, and nobody's going to stop them from raising those issues. Now, one point I would like to make is the relator keeps indicating that this wasn't a private contract. It took on a public interest type of gloss. I would argue that the case they rely upon is Cajun Electric. In that case, the court held that any time a contract must be approved, must be filed and approved by the agency, then it takes on a public interest gloss. Those types of contracts are contracts like we have under the Gas Utility Regulatory Act, where a utility, negotiates with its customers and enters into a contract that must be approved by the Railroad Commission, because that becomes a filed tariff. That is a kind of contract that takes on a public interest gloss. This contract, I would contend, is a plain vanilla contract. It was entered into. I'm sorry, my time is up.
If the PUC has exclusive jurisdiction here, is mandamus relief appropriate?
If the PUC has it, yes as to EGSI, no as to Entergy Corp.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, let me first address this alleged distinction between the claims against Entergy Corporation and Entergy Gulf States. In reality, there is no distinction regarding the subject matter jurisdiction in this case. As to both relators, exclusive subject matter jurisdiction lies with the Public Utility Commission. All the provisions of that agreement and the PUC's regulatory plan oblige Entergy Gulf States to file rate proceedings and change its rates. That is all they do. They do not have any other obligation on Entergy Corporation regarding making payment. Simply provide the Entergy Gulf States will change rates.
But how does the PUC have jurisdiction over Entergy?
In the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, it does, because Entergy Corporation quite literally submitted to the PUC's jurisdiction.
Well, you can't, though.
You can't
give them subject matter jurisdiction they don't have.
Right, but in the sense that they are a party that was requesting approval of action from the commission. They're requesting approval of their merger. They agreed to take certain steps related in the settlement agreement and in the commission's order as the quid pro quo for obtaining approval of the merger. The commission's order in the merger case orders both Entergy Corporation and Entergy Gulf States to comply with their respective obligations under that settlement agreement, under that regulatory plan. Under PURA Section 15.051, the Public Utility Commission can enforce its orders against any person. It does not say utility, it says any person who is alleged to have violated them. So they do, in fact, have a remedy against Entergy Corporation at the PUC, and therefore they could get the relief they're talking about, although we believe that the PUC would not look favorably on the claims on the merits. The customers have at no time paid anything to Entergy Corporation. They have solely paid rates to Entergy Gulf States. The only way that agreement on its own face was to be carried out was to be by rate changes, by rate cases under PURA. Those are within the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction. And I want to talk a little bit about the plaintiff's claim that somehow in the proceedings to delay competition, we breached the agreement. That is incorrect. By the time that proceeding went forward, the commission had already canceled the third rate case under the plan. Recall, in June of 2000, the commission expressly addressed this issue, and as it states in its amicus brief, as it said in its order in docket number 22356, that rate proceeding should not go forward. It's been canceled. By the time we get to the end of 2001, and the commission is wondering about whether they should go immediately to competition in Gulf State service territory, it had already canceled that third rate case. That was over with. When the commission delayed competition and decided to continue the rate freeze at the end of 2001, it had nothing to do with a regulatory plan. It was exercising its independent statutory authority under PURA Section 39.103. I disagree with Mr. Lawton's characterization that provision says the commission has to set rates consistent with the old-fashioned way of doing things. It does not. It says the commission may consider whether to change rates if it determines to delay competition. The Commission expressly considered that consistent with its independent statutory authority and determined that it would not change rates.
Has the status of the PUC proceedings changed?
The Commission is still conducting ongoing proceedings with the goal of bringing Energy Gulf State Service Territory to competition. It's conducting two different proceedings right now that are trying to lay the groundwork for a competitive market. Currently, I believe it has set a goal to conclude those proceedings in 2004.
How do you counter the argument that by failing to file the third rate case, EGSI enjoyed a windfall?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that's speculation. I think you don't know whether EGSI enjoyed a windfall if, in fact, the outcome of that case would have been a rate increase. Then ratepayers were better off. I think what it highlights, though, is that throughout this time, the only way these merger savings has been considered has been through Energy Gulf State's rate proceedings.
But I guess if you were to have none of the merger savings in this time period and you received 100% instead, that would seem to be a windfall.
Well, Your Honor, again, we're here on jurisdiction. I would say, again, there was no windfall if, in fact, we were entitled to a rate increase. Then the customers were better off. But if the customers, as they say, if the plaintiffs, as they say, we would have gotten a big rate reduction and we were keeping money that we shouldn't have, then why haven't they filed the complaint? Why haven't they filed a rate case? They certainly could do it. Mr. Lawton says they could have done it. The reason they haven't, as he indicated, is they don't think they're going to like the way the PUC would handle it. They say they're worried about the cost the PUC is going to allow us to recover if they file a rate case. Well, the outcome you might receive in a case does not determine the jurisdiction where that complaint should be heard. The fact that you might get a bad outcome doesn't mean that you can avoid exclusive jurisdiction of the PUC.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the second cause. The court will take a recess.
All rise.